You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In her latest book, Joan Williams argues, the workplace of the United States today is perfectly designed for the workforce of the 1960s. The book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter, is published by Harvard University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Joan Williams, Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, to our show today. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
Hasn't our country made significant progress for workers' rights for both men and women and racial minorities since the 1960s?
It's made very substantial progress in eliminating the most obvious kinds of gender and race discrimination and discrimination against people, individuals with disabilities and the elderly. It's made very, very, very little progress in helping Americans balance their work obligations with their family responsibilities.
Before we go further, you have left race out of this discussion. Why?
I thought I mentioned race.
Well, you do, but it's not.
Oh, I see, in the book. The reason that I don't focus on race in the book is that there's a beautiful 30-year literature exploring racial dimensions of the topics that I talk about. And there's almost nothing on class.
Because there are big differences racially and ethnically in this discussion. But the majority of people you're writing about are white Americans because they are the majority of Americans. And, well, and they set the tone for the country.
Different parts of the book focus on race differently. When I'm talking about gender bias against women, one of the things I point out is that gender bias against women differs by race. And I'm really seeking to open up that discussion, what I call the double jeopardy discussion. But this book, by and large, focuses more on class as a category of analysis.
The World Economic Forum released a report this week in which the U.S. jumped from 31st to 19th place in global gender equality. Now, that sounds like a good jump, but we're still 19th. Mm-hmm. The results were based on improvements in the wage gap and political empowerment. Isn't that a promising indicator as far as you're concerned?
The U.S. actually is probably the best country in the world for women who live the life pattern of a traditional man, and that's probably what's being reflected there. It's actually one of the most hostile environments in the developed world for mothers. And so the wage gap figure, for example, compares men who work full-time with women who work full-time. What it doesn't reflect is that the penalty for part-time workers, many of whom are mothers, is 7 times higher in the U.S., for example, than it is in many European countries.
And we'll get to that in a little while. But you say that we need to focus on men in the discussion of work and family, not just women. What are some of the workplace masculine norms that you find disturbing?
Well, I've been looking a lot lately into what we call the flexibility stigma. And if you look at the studies, if a man becomes a father and doesn't take time off, then becoming a father actually helps him on the job. But for men who take even a short time off, I'm talking about a day, they encounter lower performance evaluations and lower raises, et cetera.
Is that still the case? Is that happening with the younger generation as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, there's one of the things that the Center for Work-Life Law does is runs a hotline. And we hear from men who have taken family leave and as a result been fired. Or had really bad workplace experiences.
So is this because the employer has the notion that so many people in our society have, that the male is the king and the breadwinner in a family?
It's really an instance of employers policing men into breadwinning roles and out of caregiving roles.
And why would they do that?
I think it goes back to the way they see the ideal worker. And this is the sense in which our workplace is designed perfectly for the workforce of 1960. They still see the ideal worker as someone who starts to work in early adulthood and works full-time, full force for 40 years without a break. And, you know, that's a man married to a housewife.
But don't most, or many women anyway, also share those views on masculinity and the man's role in his home? For example, wouldn't most women be upset if the man in their relationship lost his job and didn't try all that hard to get another one, preferring to stay at home, straighten up the house a bit, watch a lot of daytime television?
You know, I think that these workforce and family, these gender norms, if you look at the literature, they're held sometimes more strongly by women than by men. And so it's certainly true that men are under tremendous pressure to be providers. You think about, you know, feminism is now all about choices. Well, whose choices are those? Those are women's choices. And if a woman is going to have a choice to stay home, that means the assumption is that her husband will support her. And that's an example of the kinds of gender pressures on men that have created a real stall in the gender revolution.
Now, you're talking about women staying at home and class. Are they related?
They actually are very much related. We think that only rich women can afford to stay home. In fact, the women in the bottom 30% of American families are most likely to stay home of any women in the entire economy, other than extremely rich women.
Is that because of the culture they come out of, or the fact that their husbands insist on having them stay at home, or because that's just the way that they understand the world to be?
It's something much more simple. They can't afford to pay for childcare. We have such a low minimum wage that it doesn't make sense for a family that's earning, you know, median income $19,000 to pay for childcare and send mom to work.
But aren't many people at the bottom of the economic ladder both working because they can't afford for only one of them to bring home a paycheck?
Well, if you look at the bottom 30% of American families, two-thirds of them are mother-headed families. So there aren't two parents there. Now, if you look at the two-parent families among that group, they're most likely of anybody in the economy to be tag-teaming, where mom works one shift and dad works another shift.
My guest is Joan C. Williams. Her latest book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. How does living up to the convention of masculine responsibility affect economic progress for women?
Well, I have actually a quote in my book about Silicon Valley. And what the quote says is that men in Silicon Valley feel the need to sort of outmacho each other. And in Silicon Valley, what that means, said the engineer who was being quoted, is being even more of a nerd than the last guy.
Well, you say that many of those masculine norms force women into the position of tomboy or femme.
The masculine norms have a specific effect on men and a specific effect on women. The effect on men we've already introduced. If you don't try to outmacho the next guy, often by working the longest hours, then you really, you know, you fall off the map. The effect of masculine norms on women is that if you think about, well, think of a hard-driving neurosurgeon. You think of a man, a white man. And so women don't seem to quite fit. And so they have to prove that they are competent over and over and over again. That's one of the major patterns of gender bias.
Prove they're as good as the guys.
Exactly.
Well, you mentioned earlier that employers kind of reinforce all of this. Do they do it across the board, or is that more likely in blue-collar situations or white-collar situations?
Well, you know, it comes from every place. Employers enforce it. Workers enforce it on each other. For example, in the blue-collar context, I have for years studied union arbitrations where workers are fired or disciplined because of a family conflict. And one of these involved a grandfather who was actually tag-teaming with his son to care for his grandson. And this guy was ordered to work mandatory overtime, and he refused. So a supervisor said, you know, tell me the reason. I can let you off for a good reason. The guy refused to say anything, but this is none of your business. This is personal. And so he was ordered to stay, and he left. He was fired for insubordination. So I was asking an anthropologist who was a friend of mine, why would a guy, a working-class guy, prefer to be fired than open his mouth and say, I have caregiving responsibilities? And the guy said it would be – the anthropologist said this would be embarrassing, sort of making a loud, you know what, at church. It's just not something that is in the everyday imagery of being a working-class guy on the job.
On the other hand, you mentioned that working class men typically contributed more working hours to childcare than upper middle class men do.
Yeah, there's a real class divide among men. Upper middle class men tend to talk the talk of gender equality, but not walk the walk so well.
They'd rather hire a nanny?
They're under such pressure at work to prove their masculinity by working crazy hours that they really can't deliver. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, working class men in sort of the missing middle, they don't talk the talk as well, but they walk the walk better.
How similar or different are the moral and child-rearing values of these two groups?
You know, they're really, really different, and I'm glad you asked me that because this is not something that we've really talked about much in the United States. But there's a real class culture gap between the professional managerial class, really the top 13% of American families, and the families in the middle 53%. And one of the important value differences that they have is that the professional managerial class, this what we call the upper middle class, puts their children under tremendous performance pressure from the very beginning. And families in the missing middle tend to think that we don't really give children that much of a time to really just be kids.
You point to an interesting and very telling study on male EMTs and physicians in Massachusetts. Can you tell us about that?
It's a truly fascinating study. It compared male physicians with emergency medical techs. And what it found was that the physicians were quite absent from their children's lives because they felt under tremendous pressure to always be at work and to show the other guys that they were the most serious and always at work. And so their interactions with their children tended to be at sort of symbolic events, sort of school play. The EMTs, the blue-collar guys, were very different. They were much more involved in their children's lives day to day. They were busy swapping shifts to make sure they could be at important events and pick up their children. And so it was that this study very much showed that the working class men were much more involved with their children's lives.
It reminds me of the plots of so many movies where dad has a high-pressure job and he promises to attend the school play or the concert or whatever that the kid is involved with. And, of course, everything conspires to prevent him from doing it. And finally, in the last scene, he does make it. And the kid spots him in the audience and they smile and everything's okay.
Everything's okay. Unfortunately, if you had told me in the 1970s that men still would be saying, oh, I forgot, I missed my children's childhood, I would have been astonished. Not much has changed.
My guest is law professor Joan C. Williams. She's written a book called Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. It's published by the University of Harvard Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Joan Williams, her book, Reshaping the World. The Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter, published by Harvard University Press. And I said University of Harvard mainly because I assumed that this would be University of California Press. You teach at the University of California.
I do. Though this actually grew out of a series of lectures, the Massey Lectures in American Civilization at Harvard.
Lisa Belkin wrote a cover article in the New York Times Magazine some years back, 2003, about mothers choosing to leave high-powered careers to raise their kids. She called it opting out. And you questioned that notion. It caused a big stir at the time.
It did. And, you know, many professional women don't opt out. They're pushed out by gender discrimination and extremely inflexible workplaces that are designed around this, you know, ideal worker married to a homemaker.
Well, wouldn't many women prefer to take on the role of family caretaker and have their spouse be the breadwinner?
You know, that's something also that varies a lot by class. Among professional women, very often their ideal is to continue in their careers, but not in a 12-hour day. If you look farther down the totem pole, women in working-class families tend to be in highly sex-segregated jobs. The level of sex segregation has really diminished, and they're not jobs that offer as many opportunities as the upper middle-class jobs. So many of those women would probably, in the best of all possible worlds, given the terrible child care options they have, they probably would prefer to stay home.
But I suspect that they also would judge those women who rush to go back to work as soon as they can as being bad mothers. I've heard that more than once.
Well, you know, the problem is if you look at the studies, the good mother is seen as someone who is always available to her children. And if you are an ideal worker, always available to your employer, you can't be always available to your children. And so, unfortunately, women judge other women all the time because they're both caught between this clash of those ideals.
So women who choose not to have children don't really face many of these problems. But so how is motherhood then the barrier to gender equality?
You know, women who choose not to have children face a different kind of problem. They are often seen as somehow deeply lacking as human beings. You're sort of treated like you're missing an arm and a leg often. So that's a different kind of gender discrimination. But mothers, what the studies show is really encounter the strongest form of workplace discrimination there is. If you give people identical resumes, one but not the other a mother, the mother is nearly 80% less likely to be hired and 100% less likely to be promoted.
Well, many women do have successful careers and also remain involved with their children. Are they perhaps making more demands from their partners at home?
Some of them are. Some of them are just completely exhausted.
Because they're really, many of them point out, we're really doing two jobs, sometimes three jobs.
American women still do five times as much routine housework and two to three times as much childcare as men do. And when a man goes to work, it doesn't have any effect on how much his wife does. But the opposite is not true.
Despite the progress the United States has made in closing the gender gap, as we mentioned earlier, doesn't it rank poorly in family policies? You also suggested that, compared to other countries in the developed world. Little beyond tax policy and short-term guaranteed maternity leave?
The U.S. is probably the most family-hostile public policy in the entire developed world.
Even though we talk about the family more than most countries.
It's so ironic. But we're one of the four countries in the world that lacks paid maternity leave, and the other three are Botswana, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea.
Well, so why is that? Why does Europe give bigger leaves, paid leaves, more tax cuts for children? And, of course, they have social insurance of all sorts, which makes it a lot easier for women to work or to decide what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. I think the reason, if you think about what we lack in the United States in terms of public policy in this arena, it's workers' rights and social subsidies. And we haven't been able to pass workers' rights or social subsidies for over 30 years. So the last part of the book really asks the question about why. Why do we have such a family-hostile public policy? And the answer that it gives is that the U.S. Politics in the U.S. has veered very sharply to the right because of what I call a broken relationship between the professional managerial class, that top 13%, and the white working class.
Well, you mentioned childcare before. Is childcare better in Europe?
It varies, but childcare, many European countries have childcare subsidies. And so you don't have what you have in the U.S., particularly for families in the middle, this tag teaming where they have to keep mom works one shift, dad works the other shift, as I mentioned. Those families have three to six times the national divorce rate. That is a really brutal way to live. In Europe, you probably have less of that because you have subsidized childcare, which, of course, is lacking in the U.S.
But isn't one of the principal reasons European governments have such progressive family policies is that they want to encourage women to have more children because birth rates are lower in those countries? How progressive is that?
You know, actually, ironically, birth rates are extremely low in the United States, except among the poor. They have extremely high birth rates. But if you look at the birth rates of the rest of the people in the country, they're similar to those in Europe, but people don't know about it.
Well, earlier this week, the New York Times ran an article on French women in the workplace, which basically stated that despite the advantages offered to them, they're still held back professionally and still have the burden of work at home as well.
Well, the French social policy around motherhood has been very explicitly designed to support, to socialize some of the costs of motherhood. It is absolutely not designed to improve women's equality, and it really hasn't. An even more striking fact, though, is that Sweden, which has had social policy designed to improve women's equality, has ended up with a more sex-segregated labor force even than the United States.
Well, in many parts of Europe, men are offered generous amounts of time to be with the children, but many of them don't take it.
Well, then that gets us back to the issue of gender pressures on men. They do take it if you design the leave so you're the father, it's use it or lose it. The father has to use some of the leave himself or the family loses it. That's the only way that men can escape those provider pressures that tell them that no man worth his salt would take time off.
Well, how much of that gender pressure is coming from the employer, which is basically how we've been talking about it? How much of it comes from your own family life? People grow up in families, in some cases, where mom stayed at home and they were told that that was the right way. In other cases, mom was gone, worked a lot. The kids felt that they were left alone way too much. It was a major topic of discussion. So we are, and then there are some people who bring up religious considerations as well. This is a lot more than just simply the way our businesses are structured.
It's you're right. These pressures on men come from the employers. They come from coworkers. They come from families. They come from in-laws. When one of the reasons I think that we're at a particularly important point right now, and that men are beginning to open up a new discussion about what it means to be a man, there was a Newsweek cover story. I don't know if you saw it several weeks ago, saying it's time for a new masculinity. And I was quoted in that story saying basically men have a choice now between either getting a lot more creative or feeling really inadequate, because the fact is that most men in the United States now cannot be old-fashioned providers. So the question is whether they're going to move on and invent a new ideal.
My guest is Joan Williams, distinguished professor of law and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. Her latest book is called Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. It's published by Harvard University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener in Jackson Heights writes, "When I returned to my job after maternity leave, I was given a 25% cut. When I complained, I was told that I could work an extra day per week and keep my higher salary. I work for a supposedly family-friendly company."
That's an example of what I call the flexibility stigma. It also may be an example of something that the Center for Work-Life Law is known for, which is called family responsibilities discrimination. That's an example of the sharp negative competence and commitment assumptions that are triggered by motherhood.
Well, not just family-friendly companies, but also politicians and even women have been talking about helping women. And you see that sometimes, that helping, in quotes, as a problem.
Well, it depends on – certainly if a father says he's helping his wife, then that implies that it's his wife's job. I think that the best way that politicians can help women in the United States is to help them out as mothers, and that requires helping out the dads too.
Well, can you explain the difference between individualized accommodations for women in the workplace and changing the workplace to reflect the realities of today's family life?
Yeah, all of that goes to what you were talking about earlier, those masculine norms. If you continue to define the ideal worker as someone who takes no time off for childbearing or child rearing, you know, you've defined someone with a man's body and men's life patterns. And to accommodate women and leave that norm is going to leave women in a mommy track.
I seem to remember reading that in this country, in Japan, some other countries, people often don't take all of their vacation time.
Mm-hmm.
And they work overtime voluntarily.
Well, what does voluntarily mean? I mean, they do work over voluntarily, but often they're under a lot of cultural pressure, both from outside and from inside the organization, not to take that vacation time as a way of proving that they're committed.
Another listener, Mark, asks, what does your research say about house husbands? I know of a couple where the woman was in a sales job and basically was making 3 to 4 times more than the husband. The marriage almost fell apart because neither one of them wanted to give in on helping out in the house. So the man got a part-time job to spend more time in the home. As a result, the stress level went down and the wife was able to focus more on her job and started to make even more money than that made up for the lack of income from the husband. What is the view of men in the support role for a female breadwinner?
Well, I think it depends on whom you ask. Certainly, for many women, the stay-at-home dad is a hero. On the other hand, if you look at the social science, business women are rated as very highly competent, similar to business men. Housewives are rated as among the lowest in competence of any group, alongside, and these are the researchers' words, the elderly, blind, retarded, and disabled. That's women. And then you add being a man stay-at-home parent on top of that, so you're not only elderly, blind, et cetera, but you're also, your manlyhood is on the line.
I just read a study a few weeks back and which suggested that men who earn less than their wives are more likely to have affairs as a way of regaining some sense of self-esteem.
That's why we need to start a new conversation about what it means to be a real man, what it means to be a good man. There are these nagging examples, and you've given a very good example, where men have this unspoken sense of what they're supposed to be that's putting them in awkward situations, to say the least.
Carl in Manhattan writes, I'm a new dad, and my firm has a generous paternity leave, but I'm afraid of what will happen to my projects if I take time off. A lot can happen in a month. I could be obsolete by the time I get back.
I think if the firm, first of all, you should know that you have a federal entitlement to take paternity leave and that they have a federal entitlement not for them not to penalize you for doing that. And you can make sure that your projects are attended to by proper transition planning. This is something that a proper manager can do if the workplace is a supportive environment. And so I think the fact is, if you fear that kind of pressure, if you're feeling that kind of pressure from the workplace, it is an example of the flexibility stigma, and it's flirting with some potential legal problems.
Well, I've had a situation where I went off on jury duty and came back and found out that my job had been reassigned. This was many years ago. And although that was illegal, I wasn't going to go to court and fight the case.
How true. You know, fighting a case is a tough thing. And as this emailer points out, men who take paternity leave are still the early adopters. It takes a brave man to be married to a liberated woman, we used to say.
Mary in Newark writes, I had a stay-at-home mom growing up, and she was completely bonkers. She was depressed and miserable all the time. It would have been better for me and my brother if she had been a bit more absentee and a bit more sane.
Well, stay-at-home moms do have sharply higher levels of depression than do mothers in women in households with two jobs.
So how do we get the conversation about masculinity and all of these roles going? It seems to me that there are so many factors that are really preventing us, psychological, economic, and everything else, from rethinking what our roles in our society should be.
You know, I think men, particularly younger men, are really hungry for this new conversation, because we have a growing sense that the ideal father is also someone who's involved day to day with kids' lives, is a nurturing father. At that point, men are also caught between a clash of social ideals, between that old-fashioned, outdated ideal worker and these new ideals of fatherhood. So I think they're really open to this.
We also, right now, are going through a time where the conservative politics is rearing its head in a big way. And one of the prominent figures there is Sarah Palin, who seems to, on the one hand, be saying that women should defer to men. On the other hand, she's assumed the role of mother, breadwinner, professional.
Sarah Palin is a fascinating figure. I think Sarah Palin's power politically comes from her ability to tap, awaken, and channel this class conflict that we were talking about that I think is driving American politics.
The reason that we're seeing so many working class people moving to the right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's really a class culture gap between upper middle class progressives and the working class. Do you remember when Sarah Palin wrote notes on her hand when she was giving a speech? And she was just waiting for someone to make fun of her, which the president's press secretary did the next day, at which point she did some class bonding with her constituency and basically said, you see how the elite belittles us.
Well, it is interesting that there was a time when the Democrats were seen as the working people's party. Republicans were seen as the party of the wealthy elites. And now it seems to be the other way around. The Democrats are being called the elites. And the Republicans are being called the populist party.
And as a Democrat, my attitude is, you know, shame on us. That's a dynamic that, unfortunately, we have fed since the 1970s. And the last couple chapters of this book seek to begin to turn that around.
Well, is this something that can be changed through government policy? Barack Obama right now has enough rebellion on his hands. Is he going to start talking about the roles of men and women in our society?
No, I think the class themes in some ways are quite different. I think that the original lectures I mentioned that this grew out of was called Obama Eats Arugula. Remember when he was talking in Iowa about the high price of arugula at Whole Foods?
Very elitist.
That was what I call a class act. He was unconsciously showing that he was of a higher class status, having gone to Harvard and now being a member of the upper middle class. The Republicans don't make those mistakes.
Even though Barack Obama comes out of a very poor family.
Absolutely. That's the irony.
And George Bush came out of a wealthy family, but seemed like an everyman.
This is an issue of manipulation of symbols, and they're very, very good at it, and we're very, very poor at it.
Joan C. Williams is a distinguished professor of law and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. Her latest book is called Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. It's published by Harvard University Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.